I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Stan Van Gundy is out as head coach of the Orlando Magic, but he's back in the news again. After being ousted in the turmoil over Dwight Howard, Van Gundy is now a political activist advocating for schools in Seminole County where he lives with his family. Van Gundy joins me for a conversation about coaching the Magic and why he got into politics. Plus, as we celebrate 5 years of Intersection on the air, we listen back to an interview with a woman who became a plaintiff in a lawsuit seeking equal access to Orange County schools when she was 11 years old. That's ahead on Intersection. Stan Van Gundy led the Orlando Magic to the team's best ever winning percentage during his 5 seasons as head coach. Van Gundy was let go in May as the team fell into turmoil over the future of Dwight Howard. Howard eventually was traded to the LA Lakers, but today Stan Van Gundy has a new job as a political activist for Seminole County Schools. He's here to talk about coaching, politics, and basketball. Stan Van Gundy, great to have you with us.
Nice to be here, and that's quite a menu of things to talk about.
Well, let's get to the thing that I'm sure is on everybody's mind. Talk to me about basketball. What do you see as the role of a basketball coach?
Well, I think anybody in any position, sports or otherwise, that is leading. One of the things I say all the time when I speak at coaching clinics now to high school coaches, to college coaches, is coaching isn't what you know. It's what you can get people to do. And I think that's the same thing in leadership, in anything. I mean, it's not what I can put down on paper and all this great knowledge I have, but what can I do? And so that's motivation, that's inspiration, that's, you know, teaching them what I know and passing it on. But the key is always what can my team go out and perform on the court? And so I think the best coaches aren't necessarily the ones who know the most technically, say, about their sport, but the ones who somehow, by being demanding, by motivating, whatever it is, you know, and the people do it in different ways. There's people do it by patting people on the back, and there's people do it by kicking people in the butt. But getting people to perform and to execute what needs to be done for the team to win. And that's what it all comes down to. What can you get other people to do?
How do you know if it's not working or if you're pushing too hard or not in the right direction? Does that necessarily translate into poor performance on the court? Or are there other ways that you might discover that, hey, this communication isn't working as well as you want it to?
Well, that's a great question. And I think there's really three answers to that. I think number one is performance. Sometimes when you've been pushing people too hard, it will start to show up in, you know, lethargic, uninspired performance because, you know, maybe you've just pushed them way too hard. They're tired, beaten down, whatever it is. Second thing is you have to listen to those people. I mean, you know, a lot of times your players will come up and you have a pretty good idea of which players may just not want to work, which is very few of them. Most of them are going to be pretty honest and they think like, you know, hey, this is really not helping me right now. We need to back off a little bit. And so you've got to listen to them and you have to build up that kind of trust. And then I think a really important third thing, and again, I think this would go way beyond coaching to any business, is you've got to have people that are working with you. For me, it was my assistant coaches who are not yes men. They're people who will be very, very honest and just say, you know what, Stan, I think we're going down the wrong path here. We need to go in a different direction. I was very lucky. I had, I think, the best staff in the NBA by a long shot, and those guys were never afraid to tell me what they thought, and I had experienced smart people. And I think it's good. You need different viewpoints, you know. Otherwise, it's just me and my myopic view, and that's not going to get it done.
And talk to me a little bit about working with big personalities on a team, like Shaquille O'Neal and Dwight Howard, who you coached on the Orlando Magic. Do you treat those players differently?
I don't think so. I mean, as a matter of fact, I've always thought that what I've done with the better players is put more demands on them. I mean, you know, the best player, I think, can always look at things two ways. I'm the best, so I'm entitled to special treatment, or I'm the best, so what's required of me is more responsibility. And I've always tried to encourage the latter, that because you're the best, because you're the more most talented, you're going to set the tone for our team. So two things. Number one, you've got to understand that and take more responsibility, but you've also got to understand that I'm going to be harder on you than I am on other people. And I think most guys are willing to accept that responsibility.
Is it common that they come into it understanding that they need to separate ego or perception of what they are by the public from what their role is on the team?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. The one thing I've always said about ego with NBA players is I would never want a guy on my team that didn't have a huge ego. Look, if
you don't want someone without
no,
a huge ego.
I mean, look,
you want the ego. You're seeking
absolutely,
it.
Mark, because you've got to think anybody who's going to go out and do their job in front of 20,000 people every night and be subject to that kind of public scrutiny, you better have a very healthy ego. If not, the situation will destroy you. I mean, it'll scare you. You know, oh boy, I don't know if I'm good enough and I'm out here in front of 20,000 people. If you don't go out there thinking you're the best player in the world or better than the guy you're playing against, you've got virtually no chance to be successful. And so I always wanted people with egos. Similarly, I wanted players on my team who wouldn't be happy sitting on the bench. You know, you want the guy to think I'm good enough to play.
Doesn't that just create a handful of management material for you to deal with, though?
To some degree. But the one thing I'll say is I think NBA players are, number one, extremely smart. And number two, for the most part, they're mature. And it's one of the things that has separated them from other very talented players who haven't made it to that level, is they're more mature and they're smarter. And I think they understand, yeah, okay, I've got this big ego. I think I should be playing ahead of whoever the teammate is. But even with that being the case, you know, I've got to do what I can in this role to help the team. Doesn't mean they're going to be happy about it all the time, but that it needs to be done. Occasionally, that's going to create problems, and you have to deal with those things on a daily basis. But I give NBA players and other athletes a great deal of credit, because these are extremely talented people, and yet they have to take their egos and subjugate them. It doesn't mean that they don't have them, but they have to subjugate those egos to work with everybody else.
Do you have to get along with a player who has a big ego to make a successful team?
You've got to get along to the, you know, to the level that, you know, it make it a good working relationship. And I think that, but I do think this, I think the players can have coaches that they may not like. They may not like the coach's style. They may not like, you know, everything the coach does. But number one, there's a respect level. And number two, they can still be very successful. They can do what they're supposed to do and be successful. So you have to get along on a professional level. And I think you have to separate the professional and the personal. I was very lucky. I liked all the guys I coached in the NBA. I really did. There wasn't a single guy the entire time I was in the NBA that I didn't like. But on the court, yeah, I'm not going to play 13 guys equal amount of minutes. And some guys are never going to play. And you have to put aside those personal things and do what's best for the outcome of the game and the, you know, and for our team. And players understand that. Doesn't mean they like it, but they understand it.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the state of the Orlando Magic since you've left. The Magic started their training camp on October 1st, and it's going to be a really interesting season because you're not there. Dwight Howard, star player, is not there. He's now with the L.A. Lakers. And we've got a new coach, Jock Vaughn, and new general manager, Rob Hennigan. So what's your read, knowing the organization as you do, for how performance will be in this upcoming season?
You know, it's a fair question, but I'm probably not the one to answer it best, because I really don't know this organization anymore. It's so different, you know. I mean, there have been so many changes. I really don't know Jock. I mean, obviously, I knew him as a player. He was a very good backup point guard in the league. I don't know any of his assistants. I don't know Rob Hennigan. And so I don't have a real feel for where they're headed. It's Rob's first general manager job. It's Jock's first coaching job. So I think how they're going to do things is going to unfold. I do think that the way people are talking about him, I think they're vastly underrating their talent. I mean, I think, you know, Jameer Nelson, Hedo Turkoglu, J.J. Redick, Glenn Davis, all coming back as core guys who played big role last year, even when Dwight went down. And while we weren't able to win the playoff series with Indiana, we were very, very competitive with a very good team. I think they've added some very good young players, really like Vucevic. J.J. and Jameer both telling me they like Gustavo Ion. I think they've got better size and depth that we had at the end of last year. But the question to me is, how much are they trying to win? And as much as that may sound funny, I mean, they want to get draft picks. They want to get higher draft picks to rebuild. And so are they going to get to a point where maybe they're playing pretty well and they say, well, you know, let's take a couple of these veteran guys and sit them down and make sure we don't win too many games. I think they could be a pretty competitive team if that's what they want. But I'm not sure how much they want to be a real competitive team.
Do you think, is it a recoverable loss to bounce back from not having Dwight Howard?
Well, not immediately. I mean, look, Dwight is one of the top two or three players in the NBA. He's not only a great talent, as I say to people, he's got the whole package because physically he's very, very talented, but he might be the smartest player I've ever coached. Certainly the smartest big guy. He can learn everything you're doing in a very short amount of time. He can adjust on the fly. He knows the personnel he has to play against in the league better than anybody I've been around. So he's a special, special guy, and still in his prime, you're not going to replace that overnight. Now, over time, yeah. I mean, Shaq left Orlando, and it was all gloom and doom. And so then Tracy McGrady comes along, and there's some pretty good years. And then he goes, but then you get the draft choice that becomes Dwight Howard. So everything in pro sports is cyclical, and immediately people will really miss, I think, the fans seeing Dwight around. But over time, they've certainly got a chance to rebuild it and be pretty good.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Stan Van Gundy, former head coach for the Orlando Magic. I'm Mark Simpson. Are you a Magic fan? You can tell us about it online at Facebook or Twitter, or send email to intersection@WMFE.org. Take me inside your last season with the Magic, and specifically that relationship with Dwight Howard. There was a lot of tension that was publicly displayed in newspaper columns, radio shows, people just talking about it. The tension between you and Howard, and you coming out and saying you thought Howard was trying to get you fired. What was going on there?
I don't think anything Dwight did during the season was trying to get me fired. Like, Dwight's not he just doesn't have it in his character to say give less of an effort or not play as well to try to have the team lose to get you fired. I was very direct. What I said was that Dwight had asked for me to be fired, which had happened. And
how do you react to something like that? Well, we know that you came out and said it, but I mean,
but not immediately. See, I had known that for quite a while. And so
did he know that you knew?
He did know. Yeah, that I knew, because I told him. And it was, the problem is you have too much speculation, like you're talking about, and it's in the paper and it's all these rumors. And in the media, it's just speculation. They don't know what's going on. My feeling, and again, my concern is with my basketball team, and not just Dwight, but you've got 11, 12, 13 other guys in that locker room that need to be focused on just winning games and don't need the distraction of everything going on. My point with our organization was I thought things needed to be cleared up. And
what things?
My status, Dwight's request, you know, it just needed to be clear where we're headed. I thought that was would have been pretty easy to do. But some people above the general manager get involved. They don't agree. Here's what I'm going to say. And I'm not saying it's wrong. Look, of course, we wanted to win as many games as we could. And of course, we wanted to hang on to Dwight Howard long term. The problem, in my opinion, is that we put hanging on to Dwight Howard, or what they thought would hang on to Dwight Howard, above the team and team goals. And that's just backwards. We can be concerned about a lot of things with players. We can be concerned with, you know, we'd love them all to play. I like those guys. With their salaries, with their family situation, whatever. But nothing can come above the team and team goals. Our organization put keeping Dwight Howard above our team goals. Now, the argument is, well, the most important thing for the team in the future is that we keep Dwight Howard. Well, number one, I don't think anything that they were doing was going to assure that Dwight would stay. And at the time, it was creating distractions at the best. Even it was actually even more than that, but creating distractions within our team. I thought that what you need to keep doing is continue to focus on what was best for the team, for the entire group, and one guy can't take precedent over all of that. So there was a lot of disagreement in terms of what could have been done. But Dwight and I never, we had professional disagreements. I'm sure anybody listening to this right now at some point in a career has had a disagreement with a boss, okay, or a coworker. There's professional disagreements. But there was never a dislike, I don't think, on either side, or a personal animosity. That situation could have been handled, but it wasn't handled well by the people above us, and it made it an impossible situation. And what I tried to do was just clear everything up. I thought, let's get rid of all the speculation. This is what happened. Yeah, he'd asked for me to be fired. Okay, speculation over. Let's move on and let's focus on playing basketball. We could have done that. I guarantee you Dwight and I could have done that.
But the media can't let go of a story like that.
I think even they would have let go of the story once it was cleared up, and I think that's what would have been good about it. The problem is, Mark, we'll never know if that approach was effective because he played two more games and he got hurt and he was done for the season. One of those two games happened to be in Philadelphia, the last game he played, one of the most courageous efforts I've seen by an athlete. I mean, he barely could move or walk, and he played 40-some minutes and got us the win because of the responsibility he felt to his teammates, because he knew what kind of week it had been for them with what had gone on with he and I. I think that would have continued. I think our relationship would have been repaired fine and everything would have gone on. But he got hurt, and we didn't get a chance to see how it would work out. And so the last thing anybody remembers about Dwight is really Dwight and I's, the press conference on April the 5th, where everything sort of came to light. That's all anybody remembers.
Stan Van Gundy, you recently, in your post-Magic life, have started getting involved in some activism in Seminole County with a group called Citizens for Preservation of Property Values. This is a group that is trying to raise property taxes to benefit the county's school system. And the school system, of course, has been suffering in Seminole County through a $73 million worth of budget cuts during the past 5 years. Voters are set to decide on the property tax increase in the general election coming up in November. So how'd you get involved with this, and why are you taking it on?
Well, I was asked to join this committee, and I say jokingly to people, but it's really true. Well, how did you get to be the chairman of the committee? And I said, well, when we looked around the room that night, everyone else had a job. So the fact that I didn't have one, I had a lot more time. But education's a passion of mine, even beyond our county. I mean, I really believe that most of the problems that we talk about nationwide, whether it's global competitiveness, whether it's unemployment, whether it's, as some people will say, the welfare state, whatever it is, all of those things are directly tied to education. That if we could provide an outstanding education system for every kid in this country, no problems will just go away, but you would see a tremendous decrease in those problems. In Seminole County, we have a school system that's done an incredible job. I mean, we're number one ranked school district in Central Florida in all of the FCAT scores. The Center for American Progress goes in and rates schools according to dollars spent, and said that we had the best return on our investment of our educational dollar in the entire state. So there's a lot of good things going on. Kids in our school district graduated last year, $45 million in college scholarships. We've got one of the most extensive career and vocational programs in the entire nation. And so all of these good things are going on, but we're sort of at a tipping point right now. You know, as you mentioned, $73 million in budget cuts over the last 5 years. And I don't think people are really aware of how dire it's gotten in terms of our spending.
Well, what happens, though, as we're still in an economic recovery, a lot of people still feeling an economic pinch, and you're asking them to approve a tax increase.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, it was interesting when we went through the process of hiring a political consultant, the first thing that the political consultants, pretty much no matter who you interviewed, agreed on is these are always the interesting issues in education, because nobody wants to pay more taxes, but everyone wants their school system to be strong. And so where do you come down on that? There's no question it's tough times, and there's no question this will raise people's taxes a bit. But I would say this, and a lot of people have agreed, people who are struggling, the last thing that they want to worry about is, because I'm struggling now, my child's education is going to suffer, giving them less chance at a great future. I don't want that to suffer. We had a woman at the Castleberry City Commission meeting the other night. You know, there was a woman who got up and said, you know, I'm a single mother. And I mean, it was really, to me, compelling testimony is, I'll work two more jobs if I have to, but I'm going to do everything I can to make sure my daughter gets the education that she deserves. And that's really sort of where you are on the issue. I think it comes down to this. It comes down to how important you think education is, not only for your own kids, but for a community. Then what do you think is required in the schools to offer kids a great education? And then whatever the cost is for that, are you willing to pay it? I mean, it really just becomes a choice. We can do education on the cheap. We can. Now, it probably won't be the education that we need, and not just for our own kids, but we're talking, again, economic problems. Well, you've got unemployment as a problem. I don't know short-term necessarily, but long-term solution is get more educated people out there, you know, and especially in our career and vocational programs. If a business wants to move into Seminole County, the number one factor for businesses relocating is workforce. They want to know that there's an educated and trained workforce out there. These are the jobs of our schools. And so we got to quit thinking short term, and we've got to start thinking more long term. How do we make all this work?
Stan Van Gundy, former head coach of the Orlando Magic. Very nice to speak with you, sir.
Nice to speak with you.
Coming up on Intersection, we continue looking back in our archive from the past 5 years at some of our most interesting conversations. This week's installment looks at living in segregated Orlando. In 1962, the NAACP started a decades-long lawsuit against Orange County schools over desegregation. At age 11, Pamela Woodley's mother told her she would be a plaintiff in the suit. Woodley told me about what it was like growing up in Orlando at that time. We spoke in 2010. I know because of your mother's involvement in the NAACP, you've got a lot of stories about growing up in Central Florida. Would you share one with us that helps illustrate what those times were like?
One I remember when the NAACP was very, very active in the civil rights movement here, they would say, you know, okay, this restaurant is supposed to be open, so we need somebody to go there. And my mom would say, okay, I'll go. And so we went to, there was a restaurant downtown that was called, it was a cafeteria-style restaurant. It's called Morrison's. And I remember the first couple of times that we went there. It was my mom, myself, and my mom's younger sister. And we would walk in, and everyone would turn around. Everybody eating dinner would turn around and look at us, because I guess it was so different.
And this is when you're a kid.
Yeah.
So what are you thinking when you see that you guys are causing this reaction?
You know, I actually thought it was somewhat humorous from my perspective. I thought, wow, you know, this is like kind of crazy. But what it taught me, I guess it taught me to feel very comfortable in any kind of environment. And I remember going to the movies. Used to be a theater called The Rocking Chair. We were the only people there, only black people there. I remember going to Daytona Beach because black people used to go to New Smyrna, not Daytona Beach. And we would be the only ones on the beach. And people would just stare. But no one, you know, did anything to us. So I wasn't afraid. And in my adult life, when I started working, I was often the only person in the office who was African-American. And I had that quite a bit in my early working years.
I think it's interesting that you said from childhood, you took that experience and you took it to be transformed into someone who is always comfortable in many different environments. It could have easily gone the other way. You could have easily been uncomfortable.
It could have. But I think a lot of that has to do with my mom, because my mother was very bold, very confident. And so as long as she was okay, I was okay.
Well, you're 11 years old. What school were you attending in Orange County? And what do you remember as a child about the segregated system, and what did it mean to you to grow up in that environment?
Well, I went to a neighborhood school. I attended Callahan Elementary. It no longer exists. It is now the Callahan Neighborhood Association. I mean, a neighborhood center. I'm thinking of association because my mom started the association. That's why the center is there. From what I remember, my school, I mean, from my perspective, my school was fine in terms of where I went.
That was your
normal. It was in my neighborhood, right?
That was your normal.
Right. It was in my neighborhood. I had great teachers. That I do remember all through school. I had wonderful, wonderful, great teachers. And I attribute my success to all of them. I don't remember having a lot of fancy things in our school. I don't necessarily recall that. But was that a problem to me from a child's perspective? No, because I didn't know what other students had in their schools.
That was Pamela Woodley talking about her experience growing up in segregated Orlando. She was part of a decades-long lawsuit to integrate Orange County schools. The NAACP and school district signed an agreement ending legal action in the case in 2010. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.